In the deepest sense, the American Revolution was a conscious majority revolution on behalf of libertarianism and against power, a libertarian ideology that stressed the conjoined rights of liberty and property. That was a quote from Murray Rothbard in the series Conceived in Liberty. And as we begin this first season of Liberty versus Power, we're going to touch on the different parts of cronyism, Liberty versus Power in America, 1607 through 1849, by my co-host, Dr. Patrick Newman. A lot of what he drove from especially this first part that we're going to cover today is inspired by Rothbard's series on this issue. So before we really dive into the topic at hand in this particular period, Patrick, can you just talk a little bit about the introduction of the book and kind of the framework that we're working from?
Yeah, sure. So one, it's a pleasure to be on. It's a pleasure to be talking about Rothbardian history, and I'm thrilled to be discussing my book. So as you mentioned, the title of my book is Cronyism, Liberty versus Power in Early America. Okay, so I explain cronyism, which are special interest policies that benefit various business and political groups at the expense of the public overall, through the lens of this liberty versus power framework, which Rothbard discussed heavily in Conceived in Liberty. This is something that greatly influenced his overall historical perspective, right? So what exactly is this liberty versus power framework? So I describe it in my introduction, and I build off of Murray Rothbard, who in turn built off of earlier historians who were studying this, researching this figuring out what contemporary Americans were thinking during this time. So the liberty versus power theory argues that history is a clash between the forces of liberty, so the forces of small government. They're against cronyism, they're in favor of free trade, hard money, minimal government spending, et cetera, et cetera. And the forces of power, so the forces of big government, the forces of cronyism, they're out for the power, they're out for the pelf and the privilege, so to speak. They support central banking, tariffs, internal improvements, and so on and so forth. When power has control of the government, cronyism goes up, right? When liberty has control of the government, cronyism goes down, or at least we would expect it to go down. The issue is that this is something Rothbard repeatedly stressed in his own historical work, and I talk about this a lot in my book, is that power corrupts. So power incentivizes people to engage in cronyism. So when libertarian reformers have control of the government, they get corrupted by power. They lose sight of their original goals. They start to dish out their own special privileges to their various supporters. They look ahead to the next election, so on and so forth, right? So this makes reform very difficult because cronyism, when the forces of liberty are in control, it only really moderately declines before it starts to increase again. This is why getting rid of cronyism is so difficult. Even when you have a mass movement, libertarian political group that's actually not only interested in winning office, they can win office, they can pass legislation reducing cronyism and so on. So this is the general structure that I'm the general theory that I'm working with, and I argue that it really explains a lot of history in during America's sort of formative years. And this is not only my opinion, this is also the opinion of Americans at the time, right? They constantly saw things through this liberty versus power lens. So all I am doing, and all really Murray Rothbard was doing, was arguing that what many Americans had insisted was true was in fact true.
And as we're going to find out through this episode and future episodes, that there's a lot of names that are usually celebrated as some of the saints of the American Revolution who are certainly not immune to the corruption of power.
Absolutely. There's no stone shall be left unturned. There's a lot of American heroes who are dabbling in various special privileges. And I try in my book to, call a spade and to show who are the cronies and who weren't.
And one of the things I think is interesting is when we begin with this period, the colonies were not intended to be conceived in liberty. They were intended to be conceived in power as extensions of kind of the old order of, the absolute kings of Europe. And feeding these sort of dynasties. Can you just talk a little bit about sort of the incubation of these colonies and you know, their direct role that they were intended to play kind of help financing things going on across the seas.
Yeah, absolutely. So Murray Rothbard describes in Conceived in Liberty, as well as in his History of Economic Thought, that before colonization, before you know the age of exploration, you really had this age of absolutism and this age of the old order, right? So the old order refers to the combination of mercantilism, so granting various special privileges to favored businesses and other groups. You know, the various economic fallacies are involved with that. A nation can only grow at the expense of other nations. You have feudalism, which is the king would basically tie his various henchmen to the land. He'd parcel out the conquests, give them land that they couldn't sell, etc. So it creates this caste system. And absolutism, the idea that the king was divine and the king, what his words came from God, so you had to listen to the king, so on and so forth. So the colonies, if we're just focusing on England, right, if you think the main players at this time were England, France, and Spain, they were all sending ships over to try and basically claim land that no one, for the most part, didn't really own. It was very relatively unsettled. So England was involved, you know, was in the practice of basically chartering these companies, giving them these companies, these corporations, various crony privileges. So then these companies would go out and settle land on the east coast of the United States. So if you think of the you think of Virginia or Massachusetts, some of the earliest colonies. And so on. So these colonies were designed to basically be raw, just raw materials markets. So they would people in the South would ship over various crops. People in the North would ship over some different types of crops or maybe lumber, etc. All of that would go to England. England would use this to make anything from furniture to weapons to ships, etc. And then they would use it for themselves, or they would sell it back to the colonies. So it was really that they were designed to be extensions of the colony, of England. They were designed to be extensions of the old order, right? And this was really, a lot of people, in an ironic sense, America was not conceived in liberty. It was conceived in power. It only became conceived in liberty due to the fact that the sheer abundance of land made it very hard to monitor colonists. England was preoccupied with various foreign wars and its own internal strife. If we think about the English Civil War and the Glorious Revolution, so on and so forth. And England, they kind of had to just sort of let the colonies engage in their smuggling, because whenever they did try to really enforce laws, the public revolted.
Yeah, and that inability to enforce, I think, overseas, again, it kind of sows enough freedom in there that, you know, I know later on, you know, it's kind of the view of the American Revolution less as a revolution sort of in a, you know, kind of the French mold. You know, it really was kind of just a war of you know, national independence, or kind of maintaining the society that had been built up, you know, from just the disconnect of, you know, the sea in between, you know, the American colonies and old Europe. And I think it's interesting looking at, you know, the 1600s as the precursor to the American Revolution itself. Obviously, you know, we had within, you know, European history, I mean, particularly, you know, Anglo history, the British Civil War, the rise of the Levellers, which gives, and I know Rothbard praises as one of the early libertarian movements. But then you also had incidents in America of kind of people sort of you know, chafing at some of the established, you know, king-oriented power structures. I know you mentioned at one point early in the book, you touched on briefly about Bacon's Rebellion, which was one of the first rebellions in the colonies. Which I'm just diving into a little bit more, you know, it was an interesting where it was kind of a broad coalition of kind of European indentured servants, slaves. It was kind of like a mass class rebellion against the current power structure. It's kind of just, you know, interesting seeing some of the precursors to what ended up fueling some of the fires, you know, a century later.
Yeah, exactly. Bacon's Rebellion, in a sense, it happened in 1676. So it was 100 years really before, really the American Revolution started in 1775. But it was 100 years before the Declaration of Independence. It was in many ways a prequel. And yeah, you got Nathaniel Bacon.
Bit of an interesting rebellion, character though, himself.
Yes, very, very interesting character. No relation to Kevin Bacon, in case as far as I was able to find out. but basically, it was a classic instance. One of Rothbard's reasons as to why his original project on American history. So he was supposed to write a 1 or 2 volume history on the United States from Jamestown to 1960, right, when the time he was starting to work on this was, he said, well, there's all this new information that I had never seen. So there's all these instances of tax rebellions. And I can't leave that out. Now, Bacon's Rebellion is a more famous instance of that, but it's still just really a sign that, yeah, and Americans, they would fight for their rights, so to speak. Yes, did the Nathaniel Bacon and his supporters want to maybe take Indian land, et cetera? Undeniably, that was a motivation, but they were upset at the ruling Virginia oligarchy, their control over the colonists. When Bacon quickly, he was able to assume power, he did enact some democratic reforms, providing for basically greater representation, these moves towards liberty. Okay, so these were good things, and trying to strike down some of the onerous taxes and regulations that the colonists were upset about. Unfortunately, and this is certainly true throughout much of American history, Bacon, like many people who led rebellions, he quickly became a despot. He quickly became like a dictator, and it would have been interesting to see what would have happened, but then he died. So then, like, the whole thing kind of fell apart.
Once again, power corrupts.
Yeah, power corrupts, absolutely. I just realized the pun I did there, right? But yeah, you see this corrupting nature of power not only affected Nathaniel Bacon, who we could consider on the side of liberty, broadly speaking, but many other later people. But these rebellions were, it was a sign that, and this is, England knew this. They recognized that, okay, we can't, at least until later on in the mid-1700s, we're not really going to try and push the colonists too much, because they have a rudimentary understanding of private property, right? They had all of this land they had settled. So they had so much abundance as opposed to your average person in Europe. They were influenced by various libertarian ideas in Europe, et cetera. England kind of had to, all right, we just got to let them do their thing, but we're still going to have control over you, but we're not gonna push it too much. At least that's what they thought.
Well, and the intellectual environment that was going on in the times, kind of helped sparked in the 1600s. But you have the rise of John Locke and John Trenchard and Thomas Gordon, Cato's Letters and things like that. There was also an intellectual revolution. Thinking about Mises's, work on the importance of ideology sort of guiding different political developments and things like that. We were kind of seeing a sort of proto-libertarian intellectual bent alongside with just the practical elements restraining what the state could do across the seas. There was an intellectual foundation that I think helped obviously fuel a lot of what had become the founding fathers later on.
Oh, absolutely. So the Enlightenment thought was becoming bigger and bigger in the late 1600s, early 1700s. So this idea that reason is a good thing. Mankind can understand the workings of the world around him, the natural laws, so to speak. And this includes the laws of what later became known as political economy, aka economics. So to understand how markets work, understand how private property works, and mankind, you think, oh, that we can learn this and we can use this to design a better world, that will improve people's living standards. So John Locke, his two treatises of government, very big in influencing this. And then later people, as you mentioned, John Trenchard and Thomas Gordon. So this was Cato's Letters, really kind of distilling John Locke to a popular audience, right? And this is the beginning of this liberty versus power theme, right? Where you've got people recognize that the government is power. The government is a cancerous tumor. Power is always encroaching. We need to set various constitutional safeguards to prevent power from encroaching. And this, they really kind of nailed this. And this is something that really animated colonists around the around this time, as well as many other later Americans.
So since we've now kind of set the stage for the environment upon which the American Revolution was to build up, and then obviously, you know, you have your kind of standard history on, you know, England trying to crack down on the colonies, the different stamp acts and things like that. I think it's worth taking a minute to just kind of look back and thinking about some of the battles over what the American Revolution really stood for. I know Rothbard goes into great detail, kind of highlighting, you know, and criticizing a lot of mainstream interpretations. You had kind of, I believe, in the early 20th century, so this idea that the American Revolution was a revolution of property owners, a minority of the population were those that really, you know, cared about all of this, you know, revolutionary stuff. A lot of people just wanted to be kind of go along with how everything was going. And then on the other, and Rothbard critiques that and points to the degree to which the American Revolution was itself a genuinely popular movement supported by all classes. And then on the other side, you kind of had this sort of conservative, what they called the consensus school, about, you know, kind of undermining and underselling some of the explicitly libertarian notions of the revolution. Can you just talk a little bit just from kind of the battle over what the American Revolution meant from this sort of historical, almost political perspective over the years?
Yeah, so the American Revolution is very important in American history, obviously. It's defined us, if you think, at least back in the good old days, so to speak, when, let's say, you and I, we were in elementary school. You would learn about the American Revolution. It was like, yeah, this was this. You think this is this great, this great struggle. You know, we beat the British. We beat the evil British Empire. I just remember when I was in elementary school, the Patriot, the movie had come out, and it was like, all right, yeah, it was a little bit of an exaggeration, so to speak, but it was still, you're like, yeah, America, this is awesome, everything's great. And now we can get into, that's a whole different conversation on how that whole thing has changed. But the meaning of the American Revolution, the interpretation, has certainly been subject to multiple transformations, criticisms, and so on as to what exactly it meant. What were the colonists fighting for? Were the colonists, so to speak, broadly what we would consider, you know, now what would be called nowadays liberal? You know, more, of the left? Was it of more of a conservative? You mentioned a minority, minority movement among property owners, aka, you know, conservatives, the right? Or was it a libertarian movement where Americans generally just interested in smaller government? And Rothbard argues the latter. I, of course, take his perspective on this because. And so he argues, he looks through the whole history of the building up to the revolution. He's got a whole volume 3 of his book, basically from the French and Indian War to the American Revolution. Because the issue is after the French and Indian War in the 1750s, Great Britain had more or less taken all of France's land in North America. They were the undisputed world superpower. It was Great Britain. And they said, all right, we're in charge now, but we aren't really making a lot of money from our colonies, or at least they're not paying what they consider their fair share. So then Great Britain decided to engage in what was known as a grand design, impose various regulations, mercantilist restrictions, start to enforce all of the laws that they had established previously. These were known as the Navigation Act, so on and so forth. And yeah, they actually wanted to raise taxes just slightly, right? But your average American was very fearful of that because they said, all right, this is just an opening wedge, right? It was just an opening wedge. So once Americans basically started to resist this, each law was protested, every tax, et cetera. And the Americans, it was really, they were fighting against taxes. There were some who wanted only just representation in Britain's government, But a majority of Americans, they were influenced by John Locke. They were influenced by the burgeoning libertarian movement. You got guys like Patrick Henry, etc. They wanted a small government. They wanted to break away from Great Britain. They wanted to do their own thing. They said, hey, look, we understand that if a government becomes despotic, we have the right to secede and form our own government. Just that basic idea is intensely libertarian. It's the ultimate attack on a state. It's literally trying to destroy it, or at least trying to break away from it. You can't really get any more libertarian than that. So the American Revolution was intensely libertarian. It was a mass movement revolution. The old saying that only a third of Americans supported the revolution, that's like this one of those classic myths that really just comes from a misreading of a John Adams letter when he was talking about like the French Revolution. But the American Revolution, it was a mass movement, unlike the U.S. Constitution, but that's a story for another time, maybe later. And Americans, they were upset. They were upset at Great Britain's depredations or perceived depredations. They wanted to stop that. They wanted to do their own thing. So I think this often gets completely neglected in, you know, presentations of the American Revolution. It kind of did before, let's say 20 years ago. It definitely does now, where the common consensus is almost that, well, Britain was actually, they were the good guys because, well, they wanted a big government. They wanted to, you know, think of all the benefits you have, the strong government around the world and blah, 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 blah. And, well, it's just the Americans, they weren't paying their fair share. And, oh, yeah, Americans, some of them were motivated by, they were fearful Britain was going to free the slaves, which is totally not true. That was, you know, it's a huge debate going on right now, but it's just, it's, that was not a, a leading factor motivating Americans to, you know, to secede. The conclusion is inescapable. It was a great battle of liberty and power. The Americans were on the side of liberty. The British were on the side of power. You know, end of story, so to speak.
And it's interesting because when we look at, you know, within the American side of the story, you know, we see these figures start lining up, you know, on their own sides within this same sort of battle. You know, one of the things you highlight is that a lot of the people that end up playing a large role in the finance side of things, they started off as loyalists, you know, with you know, at the very least, you know, wanting, or even perhaps the most, wanting representation, you know, in the UK within Parliament, but not looking for independence. People like Gouverneur Morris and Robert Morris, no relation. And then on the other side, we have, you know, kind of the diehard ideologues who were, you know, kind of embodying this sort of new liberal spirit, you know, people like Sam Adams and Patrick Henry. And it's interesting how throughout this story, some of the individuals end up, you know, far too many of the ideologues end up kind of joining the power camp as time goes on in ways that we will dive into more. But can you talk a little bit about, particularly a Gouverneur Morris, and some of kind of, again, the degree to which a lot of the financiers saw the advantages that came by being part of the power structure and trying to temper perhaps some of the radical inclinations that were going on before shots being fired in the revolution.
Yeah, so the revolution, the Americans, they quickly split into two camps. So these are the groups, this is the, you know, one group wanted, you know, independence. The other group just said, hey, look, we're going way too far, going way too fast. We need to just ask to go back in the British Empire. We just want a little bit more representation, etc. After Britain said no, as in, like, you know, we're upset at you guys, then it basically, those two groups evolved into, you know, the first group really just wanted what was known as an empire of liberty. So sort of this decentralized, the system of decentralized governments spanning across the North American continent, separate from all of the problems of Europe, all the old order stuff. You know, we got the Atlantic Ocean, right? And then you have the people who said, all right, yeah, we'll create our own government, but we want it to basically be another old order power, maybe more democratic, less monarchical, et cetera. But, you know, we want the big government stuff. So a huge proponent of this was Robert Morris. He was a prominent merchant in Philadelphia. At the time, Philadelphia was really the leading center of business in the United States. New York City would not supplant Philadelphia really until about the 1830s, 1840s. And then you have Gouverneur Morris, who is sort of one of Robert Morris's henchmen. There's no actual relationship between them, you know, familial relationship. And they recognized that the war would provide various advantages to the mercantile class, right? So the war could be used to get the stronger government that they wanted, right? The war could be used to justify raising taxes on Americans, right? Which could be used to then protect various manufacturers, to fund government spending, right? The war could justify a central bank, right? Or really a monopoly chartered bank, the first bank of the United States is a different animal. And they could, and that would obviously benefit businesses, right? Because they could acquire loans from this organization and so on. So they were very big in pushing for the, Robert Morris and his various henchmen. Alexander Hamilton was one of them, were very big in pushing for the Articles of Confederation, right? Which initially was a very strong, big government document. Because after the Declaration of Independence, you technically had these 13 independent states, right? States meaning independent, really governments. And they were sort of informally allied through this Continental Congress, just this, you know, this sort of collection of all the 13 states. And the proponents of big government after the Declaration of Independence, they wanted to now bring everyone in together in a stronger system of governance. So they said, all right, well, now we're going to create our own large country, basically. And fortunately, the forces of liberty whittled it down. But the basics was still there. You had these states that were united, so to speak, you know, the United States. And this was the opening wedge to further interventions. But it's important to note that some of the biggest supporters of government power during this time period were the mercantile class, were various businesses, which is a recurring theme in American history.
Yeah, there's a lot of things here that are recurring themes, like the Articles of Confederation being a consolidating document and then being used by the opponents of the consolidating document. We'll kind of hit on some of the parallels later on with the Constitution. But I also enjoy how quickly Robert Morris went to work. You highlight how he got like a $2 million deal done for munitions, and like $500,000 went directly to his own company. Another $300,000 went to his cronies. So it was like right off the bat, Robert Morris knows how to play this game.
Yeah, absolutely. And in a sense, obviously I'm not a fan of him, but you kind of got to admire him. At least because things were much more, yeah, things were much more frank back then. Like, yeah, all right, I'm just going to do this, support myself and, you know, and other people. Or, yeah, if you make me treasurer under the articles, yeah, I'm just going to create, like, first thing I'll do is, yeah, I want to pass a bank. And guess who's going to be the president of the bank? You know, my partner, my business partner, right? And you're like, oh, okay. The guy's name, I think, was Thomas Willing. And he was, you know, he was ahead of the Morrison Willing, this company. And so, yeah, it's very blatant. But, you know, it's certainly interesting that you're like, yeah, he knows what he wants to do. And he was sort of known as the merchant prince, so to speak. He was really, you could say, the first in modern American history, in the sense of, you know, not the colonial era, not technically linked with the British, so to speak, or an agent of the British government. He was kind of one of the head of the first, well, maybe considered power elite, right? The group of the head of the entrenched interests, you know, this small little oligarchy that controls things behind the scenes, is using it to get various special privileges. You know, it's crony, right? And this is what happens. Now, throughout American history, these power elites are fighting each other. They're clashing. You got to rise, then then they fall, all this stuff. But it's important to sort of focus, you sort of see how they're actually operating behind the scenes. Rothbard does this a lot with Morris and Conceiving Liberty. And I try to do the same thing in my own book.
Talking about some other figures that are perhaps even far more deified within the traditional story. I think one of the things I also kind of enjoy is the dynamic when it comes to military leadership, which again, I think kind of touches on this sort of old order versus kind of new order dynamic in an interesting way, is the battle over George Washington, who, you know, is dressed very much like a professional soldier, has experience within the British military, kind of definitely, you know, has some sort of Anglophile sort of tendencies in terms of the proper way of doing things. And he immediately has, you know, this kind of sort of dynamic between him and Charles Lee, who himself being, I believe, a former British officer in his own right. You know, he wants to adopt this more, you know, guerrilla warfare sort of tactic, kind of more of that patriot dynamic from the movie right there. Can you just touch a little bit on kind of, I guess this kind of gets to the very beginning, obviously, of the myth of the great Lord George Washington, you know, the secular deity of this country, but kind of, you know, right from the beginning, it's him kind of almost representing a triumph of old order over this sort of new period going on.
Yeah, so you stole my thunder. I was going to mention the Patriot too, right? Because when I was first reading this in Rothbard, because Rothbard's the fourth volume of Conceived in Liberty, which is my favorite out of the original series. I will say, I'll be biased. I say the fifth volume is my favorite overall, but that's just because I edited it. But the fourth volume could easily give a run for its money. When I was reading all of Rothbard talking about guerrilla warfare, I'm immediately thinking of Mel Gibson throwing tomahawks at British soldiers in the forest. And I was like, oh yeah, I watched this in the movie. So, you know, everything in the movies is true, right? And yeah, this was very important because a lot of people don't understand this is that, and what's also sort of ironic is that, of course, a couple of years later, we invade the Middle East and guerrilla warfare was used against us, right? But guerrilla warfare is how we won the war. We did not win the war through conventional battles, right? Conventional battles at the time where you got your soldiers, you line them up, and then the other side lines up their soldiers, and then you kind of move the troops, you know, the generals are safe at the back of the battlefield, and you're able to blow the horns and send the signals, and people are just able to dive for you, fire rounds, people aren't moving, etc. Americans were not well trained in this. The militia was not disciplined. You're going up against the best army in the world. You could not beat them in pitched battles, basically. So the way we won was we would sap at their supply lines. We would ambush them when they're moving troops, when they're moving personnel. We would occasionally flee battle to try and draw the British to pursuing us into, you know, further into a field or a forest where then you could ambush them. Those were the tactics. And it was just slowly kind of whittling away, sapping, reducing the morale of the British army. That's really how we won the war. And this was something that George Washington, right, the famous general of the American Revolution, it wasn't actually his strategy. He wanted to do the traditional standard armies, right, standing armies, financed through all the traditional means. Washington, sort of a mixed figure. He was, you know, definitely linked with Robert Morris, linked with sort of the old order. But admittedly, he did turn down being a dictator multiple times throughout his career. So you have to give the man credit where credit's due. But he wasn't really that good of a general. Great, you know, good for morale, but not a good general. If you think of his most famous battle, I think the Battle of Trenton, sending the troops across the Delaware, that was guerrilla warfare. You're surprising the enemy, right? So Washington is someone, one of those people Rothbard brings down a notch. And I try to do the same thing in my book.
In our first episode, I mentioned a little bit about Gore Vidal, who I think almost has kind of a Rothbardian streak within his American history. But you know, the first book of his series on the rise of the American Empire is Burr, which very much has I kind of love Burr's figure in American history because he really is sort of, you know, the Satan of the American Revolution. You know, despised by the Hamiltonians, despised by the Jeffersonians. You know, he's kind of made out to be this very self-serving, conniving character, but there's all these great critiques that he has of all these great men. And I think that there is something to be said about that cynical angle, though, in defense of Washington, you know, who is, you know, again, definitely, you know, as history went on, right? I mean, he does become the indispensable man, you know, for better or for worse. You know, I do know one of his strengths, you know, as a military leader was not necessarily within the field of battle, but you know, building up supply lines. You know, he was a master of the retreat, you know, which is not necessarily what you'd be known for, but like there is value within that, and that kind of plays throughout. So again, that I think that kind of ends up helping himself lend to kind of this waiting game of kind of wearing down the British. But it is interesting just also the different backgrounds of the American generals. You know, we have a lot of self-trained soldiers, Nathaniel Greene, Henry Knox, who end up having their own loyalties to the military, which has its own sort of consequences later on. Baron von Stufen, Stefan, right? Who completely made up. I mean, just all sorts of interesting characters all playing a role in the military side of things. If we touch back on this a little bit, though, you know, with kind of the new wave of intellectual developments going on during the American Revolution, kind of new ballads of liberty coming up. Obviously, you have the Declaration of Independence from Thomas Jefferson. You have overseas, something we'll touch, I think, more on in later episodes, but the Wealth of Nations ends up having a lot of consequence later on. Also the work of Thomas Paine, that there's one quote that you have in here, which again, going to some of the egos and less divine aspects of these great founding fathers, you know, that Paine's common sense stole the thunder from John Adams, who prior to that was kind of a force of liberty, but kind of unfortunately responded by drifting into the reactionary ranks. I think kind of captures the sort of ego that John Adams has.
Oh, yeah. And that is something that is, a lot of people dismiss that type of motivation as to why did people get into fights. Oh, ego. Oh, well, politicians, they wouldn't be motivated by something so trivial. I go, absolutely, they would be motivated by something so trivial. Like, they're politicians and they're big thinkers. They have enormous egos, and whenever they feel threatened, they lash out. I mean, this is one of the reasons why, Patrick Henry Patrick Henry and Thomas Jefferson, they had a nasty split. Why Madison didn't like Patrick Henry until you had Jefferson Madison, then you had Henry. Yeah, egos do matter, and so you, John Adams, unfortunately. That was kind of the beginning of when he started to move more into the reactionary side, which he really maintains throughout his life, though he does kind of – there's a flicker in the late 1790s, which is something we can get into later, but in another episode. But yeah, it does matter. Those individuals, they do have those personal reasons. But that being aside – tough for John Adams. Thomas Paine had Common Sense, and that was an enormously important book. I mean, a book, a little pamphlet, and it was symptomatic of this burgeoning libertarian thought. One of the things Rothbard discusses about Common Sense that I always enjoy was that he really kind of articulated what would be later described as the conquest theory of the state. So this is different than the contract theory of the state, which is that how governments are formed. We all get together. We all hold hands. We all decide we're going to relinquish some of our freedoms and pay taxes for protection. We sign the social contract, and the government's just like a club. It's just your friendly neighbor down the street, and you can go to it and, provides post office and all sorts of other great stuff, right? Paine goes, no, governments are created through conquest. The kings just take people's liberty. They take people's government, property. And then people are sort of resigned under the system. And, the king's despotic and all this stuff. And it's very important. That's a huge thing that a lot of people, and it's unfortunate, many libertarians, you take this contract theory of the government, and it might be good rhetorically, might be good, when you're arguing secession or something like that. It was obviously very influential with John Locke, but it's empirically not accurate. And Rothbard always went to pains to say, another pun there, went to pains to say that it really, the governments are not voluntary, governments are coercive, and a big, big part of the American tradition. I mean, that was, you think about it, that's like realizing that governments are coercive, governments are born through conquest, as Thomas Paine argued. I mean, that motivated Americans to secede. So you can't really get any more libertarian than that, right? Conquest theory of the state leads to secession. It's a pretty straightforward argument.
I think there's also some value there in the fact that Paine's work, as opposed to perhaps some of these other great thinkers that were very influential, it was very much a popular document. It was being read by normal people. And I think that conquest sort of theory of the state, that can hit people in the gut and the heart, I think, in a way that, perhaps other more intellectual arguments, they may hit some people in the brain, but you're going to, motivate a lot more people with some of that kind of fire, kind of populist approach.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is what Cato's letters did for John Locke, right? You could argue many Americans were Lockeans. right? Many Americans might know who, some Americans might know who he was, but it's sort of, even the ones who have the book, like you might not even read it, right? But it's just, oh, I got the book right here. You know, you see it, right, you know, you look all fancy. But then you've got the secondhand dealer, so to speak, the lower level that's communicating it in a short manner, right? The pamphlets of the day, this was really before newspapers. Pamphlets, you can imagine, were the 18th century tweet or, you know, blog post, right? We're like, oh, someone's got this. And then, you know, you read it and you're like, you know, your average person, my God, you know, look at this. This is ridiculous. And yeah, it's important to note it was a pamphlet, because intellectuals back then were not only, many of them, especially the ones on the side of liberty, were not only writing things in the abstract for other intellectuals, right? But they themselves or their followers were trying to distill it to politicians and other people, because this is an equally important task. You can't have one without the other. You can't only do popular stuff. You have to have the research. You can't have the research without the application, right? So when you're able to get, when the side of liberty can get both of them, it's like a 1-2 knockout punch.
So we now have in America under attack, British forces, skirmishes throughout the North and the South. We have a populace being motivated by works like Thomas Paine. We now have to deal kind of with the financing issue of this war effort. And of course, then our good friend Robert Morris comes back in. We have the establishment of the Bank of North America, which it gets congressional money to kind of help underpin it. Ends up, you know, channeling loans to his cronies with war contacts and the like. I know Rothbard uses the words, this is all kind of virtual embezzlement from Morris in this regard. And so again, we have within the fog of war, the eye of Robert Morris is still firmly fixed to the prize.
Oh, absolutely. And so really what's funny is, again, a lot of this stuff. So the war technically, I mean, it was for all intents and purposes over in 1781. There was the famous Battle of Yorktown. The rest of it was kind of a mop-up operation. You had to have various negotiations for the Treaty of Paris and so on and so forth. But Robert Morris, right when the Articles of Confederation was passed and under still this crisis of seeming wartime emergency, was pushing for a tariff to fund the national, to fund the debt that the government had contracted. They didn't have taxes to pay for any of this. So he was pushing for a tariff, or what was known as an impost. He was also pushing for a central bank. And he got a central bank, and he was very close to getting the tariff. But the issue is with the articles, every state had to ratify. You had to have unanimity.
And so we have a victory for liberty with David Howell of Rhode Island.
Yes. Libertarian professor of Rhode Island. He's fighting it. He's saying, no, we're not going to raise taxes. We're, you know, this is ridiculous. Once you do this, then you're opening up Pandora's box, basically. In little Rhode Island, little Rogues Island, which coincidentally, perhaps not, was the last state to sort of reluctantly join the Constitution. It was more or less actually forced to join. You know, Robert Morris was going to, you know, tighten the vice, so to speak. But then Virginia decided to repeal their ratification of, you know, of the impost amendment, saying, well, the war's over. We don't need to do this. And Robert Morris and everything, it literally just collapsed from there. So by the end of the war, you had the weakened Bank of North America. You had an Articles of Confederation, but there wasn't much able to be done with it. And you had this issue of all of this war debt that there were no taxes to pay for it, right? And this was a big thing that obviously motivated the U.S. creation of the U.S. Constitution.
Yeah. Before we get to that issue in particular, though, I do think it's important to highlight again, this is Washington being the great man of history. You do have an attempt for an outright military coup by Hamilton and the others. Again, I think there's some parallels here to the British Civil War a century earlier. You know, where you know, the problem is you mount this great military to defend your rights, but then the military is like, okay, we've won the war. Now, where's our money? Where's our money, right? And so you know, you have debts. Hamilton is trying to, you know, with you know, in league with some of these people in this aspiring for an old world empire within the U.S. They want to use the threat of military force to kind of force Congress to bend the knee. And this is when Washington says, no, we ain't going to do that, kid. And he's got the famous scene with the spectacles. He's gone blind in their service and all that sort of stuff. But this is an example of Washington, you know, being a great man and elevating himself beyond kind of simply personal motivations or even that of his soldiers.
Yeah. So there's a great book that came out really around the same time Rothbard was writing Conceiving Liberty. It's a book I reference in my own book. It's called Eagle and Sword by Richard Cohn. And it also just looks cool because it has the cover has this like awesome militaristic eagle, and it's got like a sword and a shield, and it's all this awesome stuff. And it goes through this Nuremberg conspiracy because, yeah, this was an actual thing. It was sort of ruminations about a potential military coup. Basically, all the military officials, they said, we want pensions. We want the good stuff, and you guys better raise these taxes. And if Washington went along, there was probably a fairly decent chance it would have succeeded, right? Because what traditionally happened with most rebellions throughout history up until that point was that, okay, the guy in charge, he would only temporarily have power, but he would then never relinquish it. And like Washington could have easily become a monarch, and he chose not to. Instead, he really embodied the Roman quinquennatus, right? The dictator, the military guy who Rome called upon to save them from barbarian hordes, and he becomes temporary military dictator, and then he gives up the power. Right, because Americans back then, George Washington included, were obsessed, literally to the point of like Roman virtue and like the Republic, and all of that. And well, yeah, Washington nixes it, so you don't have this coup. It will not be the last time Hamilton tried sort of tactics of that nature. But anyway, Washington basically said no, so the whole thing more or less collapsed, right? And then we're in the era of the Articles of Confederation in the 1700s.
Of course, unfortunately, after the war is over, Treaty of Paris 1783, we're now looking around, and America's in a state of a post-war depression. Incredible damage to, obviously, we don't have quite that cushy trading relationship with England anymore. There's a lot of damage. I mean, the amount of pillaging and destruction that had to occur during the war from both sides, it plays a major mark. I believe you mentioned that the American economy doesn't really recover from its pre-war position until 1800, a few decades later. And so the response to this is that now, okay, we've now gotten rid of the king. We now have the Articles of Confederation in play as a national structure, but then we have individual state governments, many of which are kind of now utilizing their own power. They're becoming instruments of power within their own right. I know that some of the methods dealing with debt repayment become a very big issue that ends up fueling kind of a new generation of rebellion of, again, the state authorities kind of overplaying their hand, trying to get water from a stone, if you will, and trying to tax the population in ways that they just can't handle it. Can just touch on a little bit about the policies of the state governments that end up fueling things like Shays' Rebellion here on out.
Yeah, absolutely. So the state governments, the issue was how to pay for the war debts, right? So how to pay for the mass amount of war debts. And the libertarian solution would have been to repudiate or default, at least in some form, which is what many people had argued. But there were various reactionaries who had bought this debt at highly depreciated rates from the soldiers and the merchants who were given them in lieu of actual payment of money. And they wanted governments to bail them out at par. Right. So they wanted to make a speculative killing. So various states such as Massachusetts were raising taxes to fund this debt. These taxes fell on poor farmers, and this encouraged Shays' Rebellion, which is really a tax rebellion. Right. Other states such as really those in the South defaulted. They lowered taxes. They paid off their debts, etc. Massachusetts and other northern states chose to sort of maintain this debt or to not default and paid off at depreciated rates. And so Shays' Rebellion was a symptom of that. It was a fight against tax collection. And many people, one way they would repudiate the debt was they just argued print money, right? Which was print money and just pay bondholders in this printed money. So it's like, here you go, right? And so in a weird sense, the forces of liberty were in favor of paper money, not for legal tender, not because they thought it would stimulate the economy, but this was simply just because they had, that's how they had repudiated the debt. And this was a big issue that motivated the Constitution among various other privileges, which was we need to find a way to raise money for the government. Right? Because otherwise the Articles of Confederation will just simply not work. And you're going to have multiple confederacies that will basically sort of coexist, you know, a northern, a mid-Atlantic, a southern, maybe a western, et cetera, a confederacy, and so on. So they, various reactionaries push for the Constitution. They push for this constitutional convention, notably Alexander Hamilton, Gouverneur Morris, Robert Morris, James Madison, etc. And they're pushing for this, and they get the Constitution, which is really what the Articles of Confederation was supposed to be. It was a big government document that gave the central government a lot of power, gave it the power to charter a stronger central bank, to fund debts, to raise taxes for internal improvements, to raise taxes for standing armies. You had a powerful chief executive who could, Congress could create various executive cabinets for this chief. It could also create a Supreme Court, et cetera. And so it's important to understand, because Rothbard argues this and I do as well, the Constitution was not intended to be a limited government document. It was intended to be a big government document. And this is something I really go at pains to describe into to sort of to show in cronyism, right? Because it's no coincidence that the people who were fighting the Constitution were genuine, you know, the libertarians, the original fighters of the, you know, the people supporting independence the most, guys like Patrick Henry. You know, et cetera.
And it's that's one of the tragedies of Shays' Rebellion. It's interesting watching like reading Rothbard's description of it in Conceived in Liberty 5. You know, he points out that, you know, again, that the anger was just, if I recall correctly, some of these states were actually requiring like specie payments for the payment of debts, which was kind of just like rubbing, you know, adding insult to injury when these farmers only had access to like the devalued paper currency. I mean, it was just kind of the worst way. If you were to design something to make it the worst way possible to help average farmers, like that would be it right there, right? And so that there was something that's going to end up having to break from that. And then, you know, the targets of these rebellions were just targets, right? Yeah, they were courthouses that were where the trials were being held to deal with indebted farmers. You know, it was targeting tax collectors and the like. So it's not as if, you know, they were burning down Target in the name of social justice. You know, they were actually targeting the institutions of systemic power, destroying their livelihoods. And yet, as the result of this chaos, you had a lot of, you know, let's just, you know, use the phrase liberals that were kind of disturbed by that disorder, that ended up joining this kind of rising nationalist faction that helped kind of, you know, set the stage for the Constitution and its consequences there on out. Is that correct?
Oh yeah, I think that's that line of reasoning is correct. It's just something Rothbard mentions and I describe as well. You had this fracturing among the forces of liberty. Shays' Rebellion had scared a lot of people. Thomas Jefferson was one of the few who was not disturbed by it, though he was in France.
He wasn't afraid of a little bloodshed.
Exactly. Thomas, you know, the Jefferson. Tree of Liberty, it's got to be watered from time to time, right? With the blood of, you know, patriots and tyrants, I guess.
If Stalin had said that, it would seem quite like you wouldn't be surprised.
And you're like, Tommy, what are you saying? But you know that's how he was. But yeah, it really did lead to the growth of the nationalists, who then sort of strategically called themselves Federalists. And normally federalism, how originally it was described, is a balance of power between the federal government and the states, right? Then the nationalists said, all right, scratch the states. We want to reduce the power of the states. We'll say the federal government will be, you know, the power will be constrained through the various branches. So you got the executive, the legislative, judicial, and they'll all sort of constrain each other But of course, it overlooks the fact that they can all join forces, right? And then screw the states and the people, something that's much harder than getting all the states to join forces with the federal government. So this was really kind of the motivating factor behind the U.S. Constitution. Weaken the power of the states, establish an empire of liberty that has a strong central government that can provide various crony favors to bankers, debt holders, promoters of internal improvements, military officials, and so on and so forth.
And we have now set the stage for, again, what was an extra legal coup. It was an overthrow of the standing regime beyond the orders that they were, you know, allowed to have by whatever they were claiming to have, their legitimacy comes from, right? And I one of the things I love that Rothbard highlights, and it's something I never really thought of, is that, you know, why is George Washington here at this convention? And then, like, in hindsight, it seems like, oh, well, obviously, because he's leading this thing. But in the moment, right, where this is not supposed to be going on, the reason why George Washington is here is because little Jimmy, James Madison, has the right idea that the reason why the Hamiltonian nationalist coup failed back in the day is because they didn't have Washington on their side. So we're going to bring him in. We're going to make him part of the conspiracy. And by having George Washington be involved, and people like Ben Franklin and others, we're going to defend this, you know, illegal use of power. We're going to staple it to their reputations. And from that, this is going to be the weapon, the mechanism that we're going to now use to impose this new order that we have created onto the people.
Yeah, absolutely. Washington, I believe, is a Forrest MacDonald said, someone who Rothbard references in Conceding Liberty. He's just lent his prestige. The proceedings, because you got to imagine Washington was tall for his time. I mean, he was sort of like average height, a little bit average, like I think like above 6'1", 6'2", something like that, which was like a giant back then. And you've obviously got the legendary general.
Yeah, we're pretty much standing next to James Madison.
Yeah, little Jimmy, as he's referred to affectionately. He's like 5'2", right? So Washington, he's this powerful, imposing figure. And of course, he supported the Constitution during the ratification debates. And so, well, if Washington supports it, well, then, you know, he's Washington. And this led to a lot of, basically enormous influence. And so, yeah, this was... And also, Washington probably knew, though he wasn't actually super looking forward to it, but it was still, you could say, it probably affected. I mean, he was going to be president. Most people knew that he was going to be the first president because it was like, who else? You're going to choose the famous general that everybody knows and loves, right? And so that obviously adds an enormous amount of prestige to the government. Now, what people don't know is that if in the 1780s and 1790s, if Washington was the most famous American, number two was actually Patrick Henry, right? He was just seen because he was the give me liberty or give me death. And, you know, he was the great orator. Everybody knew he was going to be the a factor at the Virginia ratification convention. So he was sort of against it, right? And he didn't attend the Constitutional Convention, at least because so we're told he smelt a rat, this famous saying. He knew something was up. And he would turn out to be, it turned out to be correct.
And that's one of the things I think is interesting within kind of the debates. You know, history has proven right, the anti-federalists, so many of these figures that there's, you know, they say, if we do X, Y is going to happen. And sure enough, and yet these are the people we don't really talk about in terms of their content, right? Patrick Henry, luckily, he's got that one killer line and that kind of makes in the textbooks. But we kind of overlook all of these thinkers that were, again, history proved right. It's the people that were either intentionally lying or just naive that we end up celebrating, it's 200 plus years later, which I don't think is out of coincidence, right? That kind of goes to exactly why history is a battlefield of modern politics. But when you kind of, as we're kind of wrapping up here, one of the things that I enjoy about your narrative, or perhaps it's unfortunate about your narrative, is like how many of the big names end up just becoming corrupted. Kind of right this time, you talk about the corruption of Edmund Randolph, who ends up being a very massive blow to the anti-federalist cause in Virginia and elsewhere. You've got a John Hancock, who is bribed with future positions of power. You've got Sam Adams that gets brought down, right? It seems like the who's who of American revolutionary heroes that are now either being bribed by the potential of power or money or contracts or whatever. And just one by one, they just start falling.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the funniest thing, because like Edmund Randolph, all right, becomes Washington's attorney general, I think. You know, John Hancock, they basically lie to him. But with him, it's the funniest because like Hancock was really sick, and they wanted him to make this speech at the Massachusetts convention. So like apparently I read in a book, they like bring him in on like his bed. Like Sova's always like coming in, and he's like, yeah, I support the Constitution, because he thought he'd be vice president. And he's like, also, I have these amendments. And like the Federalists gave him those amendments. They were just, it's like, oh yeah, we'll pass all this stuff after you give us the keys to the kingdom, so to speak, which is like literally the worst idea. It's like, you know, let's give all of the guns to one group, and then we'll have, you know, we'll all be able to decide rules together. And it's like, no, it doesn't actually work like that. But yeah, I mean, they got corrupted. This was an issue. It even happened in New York, which was very against the Constitution. I think it ratified it by like a razor thin margin, very small. But there was a couple delegates that were basically taken away. And this is a recurring theme in American history, because you have these people who are genuinely interested in reform, and they sell out. So there obviously is a difference between some people, they'll just say rhetoric, like, you know, Republicans nowadays, many of them, they'll talk the free market, you know, up the wazoo, right? But they're not actually going to support. But these guys, they were genuinely free market, or at least, you know, in varying shades. But yeah, they got corrupted, and you kind of like, you go, oh, well, that's unfortunate.
Well, then you have the dynamic, and I think you mentioned with George Clinton, if I recall correctly, where you get to the point where if you recognize where the winds are going, then the worst thing that you can do is to then work your, you know, take a principled stand that puts you out of power. And which, you know, I think ends up playing some significance. We're going to, you know, I think next week's episode, we're going to focus on the way that the Jeffersonians are able to make the Constitution kind of use it for their own purposes. But, you know, that only further kind of incubates this sort of push towards adopting the Constitution, is that it gets to the point where if you take that principled stand, you're going to be on the outside looking in, and it's going to be your enemies that are going to be the ones that are benefiting from this document.
Oh, yeah. And it's a huge problem. And one of the issues that makes this whole constitutional thing very difficult is that the Federalists were smart. I don't actually speak about this in my book because I wasn't able to get like definitive proof on this, but I'm fairly certain it's true, is that obviously, as we all know, in order to be an officer, in order to be serving as the Constitution, you know, the politician or whatever, you have to take an oath or an affirmation to uphold it. You have to act like you're in the, you know, you support the Constitution. You can't be intentionally subverting it. So you have to argue all of your acts are constitutional, right? So this is even like nowadays, you got Elizabeth Warren, you know, uber progressive Democrat, a socialist, arguing all sorts of stuff. You know, she's going to say it's constitutional, right? And so now you have the anti-federalists, the guys on the outside, they're going to have to say, all right, well, we lost. The Constitution's in place. So how are we going to whittle it down? Well, now we just got to start arguing that everything we want is constitutional. And this is something George Clinton wanted to do, because he wanted to be vice president. Back then, the tickets were separate, and he wanted to basically sort of like slowly destroy the Constitution, which is, the Federalists were like, oh no, we can't have that. So yeah, and it's a very interesting dynamic that I think it gets neglected, but it is an issue where if you don't, you know, one, outside the point you were making, you gotta, if you don't sell out, well, then other people are going to sell out and you're going to lose your influence. But now you actually have to work within this system. You can't fight the government. You can't secede from the U.S. Constitution. At least none of the anti-federalists thought that would be a good idea. You basically have to work within it. But that's a story for, I guess, then.
And also just the degree to which the Federalists had power, had control over very important institutions. I know you mentioned how one particular anecdote, the degree to which mail for the Federalists would travel between 6 to 14 days, whereas the anti-Federalists trying to get their own ideas out there, the mail would travel 6 to 10 weeks. And so while I think, if I recall correctly, Rothbard kind of dismisses the grand importance of the Federalist Papers as kind of the, you know, its position is kind of celebrated, you know, wrongly from his sort of perspective, as really being that influential document that pushed the levers. It seemed obviously that the anti-federalists, even in spite of all the intellectual arguments they could make with the anti-federalist papers and whatnot, just simply the degree to which their ideas could spread in the country was severely limited because of the other side having power and being willing to use it.
Yeah, absolutely. It was the modern, you know, Twitter ban or Twitter censoring, right? Nothing's changed. I mean, obviously, it's changed. Technology's changed, but it's the same thing. Forces of big government have always been able to use their control of the media to sway opinion. The strategic development, how each state ratified the Constitution, selective reporting of information, saying certain people were in favor even though they weren't. Yeah, it's all linked. And even, the Federalist Papers were basically just propaganda tools. They were basically just propaganda pieces.
And looking back, it's funny because I think there's a lot of the critiques of the American Revolution that we addressed earlier being wrong that very much do apply to the Constitution. For example, both you and Rothbard highlight that the Constitution was not a popular document. That while it did win ratification with the conventions, there were various mechanisms that we would address for that. The majority of the people, the public itself, were not necessarily calling for this. I think in Massachusetts, the anti-federalists tended to be poor farmers. The federalists tended to be the merchant class. And so they ended up telling the farmers of Massachusetts that, that they paid for their trip to the convention, but wouldn't pay for their trip back home if they voted for the darn thing. And so again, you have this very interesting class dynamic where again, it was the elite, shall we say, that were the biggest benefactors from this consolidation of power. And it was the public as a whole that were either, apathetic or hostile to what they recognized as that rat that Patrick Henry was smelling.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, all sorts of dirty tricks, shenanigans, delegate malapportionment, bribery, broken promises, all that stuff was used. So this was not the social contract theory that we're told. This was much more like the state conquest theory, most notably with Rhode Island when we basically threatened it with retaliatory trade legislation, right? And we forced them to join more or less. And yeah, it is something that deserves to be explained. Right? This is something Rothbard did in Conceiving Liberty. This is something also I do in my own.
And I feel like this kind of goes directly to a core and says some of the continued divides within, let's call it the American right broadly. We can talk about just in libertarian circles. There is a tendency from some libertarian factions out there to kind of really celebrate the Constitution as a document of liberty. And whereas kind of this Rothbardian perspective is still kind of skeptical of the degree to which it had already given way to the state and the consolidation of power. And I think that this sort of divide, it continues to have ramifications to this day, which is why kind of taking this sort of cynical look at this period, even though it can be uneasy, right? It's a little bit uneasy in 2021, seeing the social environment that we're in, right? Seeing the statues of Jefferson and Washington, et cetera, being torn down. It kind of feels a little wrong to be being critical of George Washington for justified reasons, right? Because there is, I think, a reflex that I know I personally feel in defending, right, this American nation, the great men of history. Yet it's important to recognize because, again, there's so much parallels that we still face today where this dynamic, again, this is why this liberty versus power framework has such broad applications throughout history. Learning the proper lessons from this moment, even if it means taking inconvenient stands against some of the secular gods of our founding, it has important lessons for that we can apply today as we try to identify ways to rein in the regime that we are burdened with as Americans in the 21st century.
Yeah, a lot of people treat, the U.S. Constitution is a small government document. So, as long as we just go back, we'll be fine. That strict constructionist view itself was a strategy, right? So we want to try and apply similar strategies to the modern world. We understand the Constitution's defective, right? So we're going to try and use extra constitutional means, things like secession, nullification,
really trying to fight the quote unquote federalism with the proper federalism, right? The history does provide lessons for today.
Got to revive the spirit of 1776. So with that being said, again, this has been part one of Cronyism, Liberty versus Power in America, 1607 to 1849. We now have the stage set, the Constitution's in place, George Washington is president, James Madison's building up departments, Hamilton's about to become your Treasury Secretary. You've got all sorts of new villains and heroes to come about in next week's episode. As always, I've enjoyed this conversation, Patrick. And if you are enjoying the show, please go ahead, subscribe, rate, review, tell your friends for this Mises History Podcast, Liberty versus Power. Until next time, this has been Tho Bishop, Patrick Newman. Join us next week.